This podcast is made possible through listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. And the Florence County Museum, presenting Kindred Spirit, The Personal Worlds of William H. Johnson, exploring the painter's artistic evolution and journey of self-discovery from rural South Carolina to Europe and New York, flocomuseum.org. And Meadow Garden, home of George Walton, one of the youngest signers of the Declaration of Independence. Open for tours Monday through Friday, 10 to 4. Learn more at historicmeadowgarden.org and visit augusta.com.
From South Carolina Public Radio, this is Walter Edgar's Journal. I'm Walter Edgar, welcoming you to our podcast series about South Carolina culture and history with a nod to all things Southern. Today, Alfred Turner and I will be talking with Diane Vecchio about her book, Peddlers, Merchants, and Manufacturers, How Jewish Entrepreneurs Built Economy and Community in Upcountry South Carolina.
In the book, Diane examines the diverse economic experiences of Jews who settled in upcountry South Carolina. Like other parts of the so-called New South, the upcountry was a center of textile manufacturing and new business opportunities that drew entrepreneurial energy to the region.
Working with the rich set of oral histories, memoirs, and traditional historical documents, Vecchio provides an important corrective to the history of manufacturing in South Carolina. She explores Jewish community development and describes how Jewish business leaders also became civic leaders and affected social, political, and cultural life. Diane, before we get into talking about your latest book, our listeners would like to know a little bit about you. How did you get to South Carolina from upstate New York?
I am from Central New York. I did my PhD at Syracuse University, and that's where I met my husband, who was the Dean of Arts and Sciences at State University of New York at Cortland. So he was interested in moving up in college administration. And from Cortland, we moved to Wisconsin. He was the vice chancellor for academic affairs at the University of Wisconsin, Parkside. And 6 years later, he decided to look into a presidency. So after looking at several colleges, mostly in the upper Midwest and Northeast, he was invited to come to the University of South Carolina, Spartanburg. And on the final visit, I came with him, and frankly, we fell in love with South Carolina. So he took the position, and about a year later, I was hired at Furman University in the history department.
And that's when we connected on any number of ventures involving state and local history. You have a long history of the study of immigrants in America, particularly Italian immigrants, and also the role of women. What attracted you to the area of the Jewish community in the upstate of South Carolina?
Yeah, that's a good question. When we moved down here, because in fact, as you say, most of my work had been on Italians. A previous book I published was on Italian women and their role in the economy in the United States. When I moved to South Carolina, I was looking for another immigrant group to study. And I was always interested in local history. So I did a lot of research, and I found that of all the immigrants in South Carolina, Jews made up the largest percentage of immigrant groups, especially in the upstate. So I decided to look into their economic activities.
You just said something very interesting, the fact that certainly in post-Civil War America, in terms of immigration to South Carolina, which was never very large anyway, but to the largest group were Jewish immigrants. Years ago, I had a graduate student, Paula Stathakis, who did Greek immigration to South Carolina, and they were actually recruited by the state to try to increase the white population. In fact, the term was used, they were almost white, but they were white enough to try to counteract the 60% African-American population in South Carolina.
Okay, I need to ask, clarify that for me. They were recruiting Greek immigrants.
Greek and Syrian. They were Catholic and Greek Orthodox.
Right.
But this
was almost quite, quote unquote.
That was the term that was used in state documentation.
They were
white enough to counterbalance.
Right.
I continue to be shocked and amazed. And we've been doing South Carolina history together, you and I, since 2006. I continue to be shocked and amazed. Okay. Thank you. I'll sit in the corner now and get over this.
Well, and I'll just add a footnote to that is the Greek community, many of them went to small town South Carolina, and they became the backbone of the restaurant business in small town South Carolina.
Yeah.
As one of my colleagues used to say, you two professors are digressing. We need to get back to the topic of Jewish immigration to South Carolina. So, Diane, continue your story. That attracted you because they were the largest number. Many people may be familiar with certainly the pre-1800 history of Jews in South Carolina, the fact that they had freedom of worship, economic opportunity. Even after the 1778 Constitution, they could vote. As Robert Rosen used to point out, Charleston had the largest Jewish population of any city in the United States into the 1820s, just as South Carolina had the largest Jewish population of any state in the Union. That, of course, changed, and part of the change came from the origin of those immigrants. And you want to talk about the difference between the Sephardim and the Ashkenazi?
As you mentioned, the Jewish immigrants who settled in Charleston made up the largest number of immigrants in America at the time in the 17th century. They were mostly Sephardim, and the Sephardim came from places like Portugal and Spain. Many of them had been driven out of the country of origin and fled first to England and then to Amsterdam, where they were tolerated. And the Sephardim Jews were deeply involved in trade and commerce. Naturally, Charleston, as a port city, offered a lot of opportunities, especially in the years, the 17th century, when the American colonies are just getting established. So the earliest Jewish immigrants to Charleston tend to be the Sephardim, who are well educated and well experienced in trade and commerce. They differ from the later Jewish immigrants who came from Germany and Central Europe, known as the Ashkenazi Jews. And then they even differ from the latter group that I mention in the book, who tend to be most of the immigrants who settle in the upcountry. And those are East European Jews. So the upcountry has a combination of Ashkenazi German Jews, as well as Eastern Europe or Yiddish speaking Jews who settle here in the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
So we're really talking here about Poland and, of course, Poland didn't exist, but Polish and Ukrainians, right?
Exactly. And Russian Jews, right. Russian Jews would, of course, have covered all of the Russian Empire at the time, which included Ukraine, which included Poland, etc., Lithuania. Yeah, so all of those Jews coming from that part of the world would have come under, the auspices of the Russian Empire.
The title of your book, Peddlers, Merchants, and Manufacturers. When they came over to South Carolina, what is sort of a typical, if you can have a typical story of a Jewish immigrant to Abbeville or Greenville or Spartanburg after 1875?
Actually, one of my favorite stories is about a peddler. That peddler is a man by the name of Nathan Shapiro. Shapiro kind of slipped out of Russia during a period of time when Jews were being conscripted into the Russian army. And, you know, once you got conscripted into the Russian army, you were in for 25 years. So a lot of Jews tried to get out of that at the time. Shapiro is one of them. I'm not sure how he did it, but he got out of Russia, came to the United States, and met up with a cousin of his, a man by the name of Levine. And Levine was also a peddler. He actually is the one who got Nathan Shapiro involved in peddling. Shapiro first went to Baltimore to meet up with this cousin, and he talked to him about peddling. And Levine had peddled previously in the South Carolina upcountry. So they purchased goods from a major Jewish entrepreneur by the name of, now it's escaping me.
It's Epstein, is it not?
Epstein, yeah. I've written so much about him, you'd think I know him by heart. Anyway, Epstein loaned him money and gave him a lot of merchandise on credit, which is another way, you know, the Jewish population supported other Jews. And with the understanding that, you know, after he had peddled and made some money, he would pay back Epstein. So the cousins took off for Union, South Carolina, which was quite a fruitful place for peddling in the late 19th century. Nathan Shapiro peddled here for a couple of decades and had a very good experience peddling. He often stayed in the homes of local union people who, when they offered to put him up for the night, they didn't charge him. And they were also very adept at understanding his religious restrictions about food because they never served him pork. And pork, of course, was a common breakfast food for a lot of Southerners. So he had a very productive career as a peddler in Union. And later, he took the money he saved and he became a store owner. He became the proprietor of his own dry goods store on Main Street in Union.
Several of the stories you have about other peddlers, it was rather common in rural South Carolina, and I gather rural America, yeah, the little market towns, but the peddlers reached to the farmers who didn't get into town. You describe one family where the children said it was like Santa Claus when the peddler opened his pack and showed all these wonders that were now available to the housewife.
Right. I got a big kick out of that story. That story was written as part of Caroline Coleman's reminiscence of growing up in rural Greenville County. And yeah, she's the one who said we couldn't wait for the peddlers to come because they would open up their sacks and they would have all kinds of goods that these rural farm people had no access to. So it was often the only way that a lot of the rural folk were able to make purchases because they often didn't have transportation or the wherewithal to get to the market towns.
And Shapiro, of course, established his own shop, his own store. And before we started recording, you and I were discussing the fact that throughout rural South Carolina, and not just in the upcountry, some peddlers stayed put. They in Bamberg or Batesburg or Swansea or North or what have you, they had a small dry goods store, and it was part of the community, but they were very isolated because they might be the only Jewish family in town. And also, the Jewish merchants were known for the fact that they welcomed Black customers, which may or may not have been too popular with some of the community, but that was part of their story.
Exactly. To respond to the first part of your comment, Jews often found themselves very isolated in these small communities, whether they were peddlers or merchants. But sometimes there was only one, quote, Jew store in town, which meant that they had no compatriots. They had no co-religionists. And most of these Jewish merchants, people who became merchants, realized that they could indeed be the only Jewish family in a community. And they realized that was the cost they had to pay for getting ahead economically. And part of it was the isolation. Now, in some towns, there were more than one or two Jewish peddlers or merchants. In that case, you know, at least they had camaraderie with other Jews. But a lot of the time, they were out there on their own.
In the upstate, other than the major communities and market towns, and I include places like Abbeville and Union and, of course, Greenville and Spartanburg, in the smaller towns, Piedmont and whatever, those men were isolated. How did they create family life? Because there's not much of a community. Where do they get their wives and start their families? How does that network go?
Most of the Jewish men who immigrated to the upstate did immigrate with spouses. So I'd say the majority of them already had a spouse with them. As far as creating a sense of, you know, social ties, they often had to go to other towns to make that happen. So, for example, the Jewish people living in Union, whether they were peddlers or merchants, there may have only been two or three or four or five of them at a time, they would travel to Spartanburg to attend the synagogue, you know, or the temple, and they would make connections with Jews in other parts of the state. Because Jews were intent on having their children marry other Jews, at this time at least, they often had their children attend youth events, let's say in Charleston or even Savannah, so they could have an opportunity to meet other young Jewish people. There would be dances, games, just social events, so that they would be able to meet up with other young Jewish people.
And of course, that older Charleston Jewish community, to a certain extent, was a fairly closed group.
It was, yeah. It was an elite group. The Jews of Charleston, they tended to be better educated, upper middle class, Jewish entrepreneurs, Jewish merchants. And of course, they had very active synagogues. The first Reform synagogue in America started in Charleston.
Yes, yes. As the number of Jewish immigrants increases in the upcountry, are they beginning to have a blowback? Is there a anti-Semitism? Certainly in the early 20th century, you've got at least the 20s, you've got the New Klan, but do they face obstacles?
Interestingly enough, there were very few obstacles they faced in the early years of settlement. I think that upstate South Carolinians saw them as contributing to the profitability of the cities. They started businesses and they helped bring new products, new clothing lines. They were business people like so many of the other middle class residents of the upstate. But notwithstanding that, there were a couple of incidents very early on of anti-Semitism. And I found out about that from a diary that was located. His name was Belton. He was a student at Furman University. And actually, I think he was a graduate of Furman University. And he belonged to a group of young men known as the Invisibles. And they were the only ones that I have ever come across that engaged in anti-Semitic behavior. But I think it has a lot to do with the fact that this is in the years the immediate years preceding the Civil War, when Jewish merchants were very open as far as having Black people frequent their businesses. Jews tended not to discriminate against Blacks. And of course, that was not the modus operandi in the South. The Jewish merchants allowed Blacks to come into their stores, look at merchandise, try on their merchandise, made them feel quite comfortable. So that was not acceptable to the majority of white Southerners. So I think that what happens in the years preceding the Civil War is that there were a couple of Jewish stores in Greenville who were openly friendly with Blacks, and some of these younger people, especially that group called the Invisibles, didn't like it. And I think they did not like it, especially because these are years when there's extreme, you know, Southern nationalism occurring. You know, we're headed toward the Civil War, and the fact that Jews are immigrants and are, you know, accepting Blacks into their stores and Blacks are hanging around their stores made these young white Southern men very upset. So I think it's a combination of anti-Black, you know, the kind of things that went on in the South, combined with, you know, these foreigners who are willing to let them come into their stores and, quote, hang out there. And I think this is what led to some of these incidents. And they were pretty ugly incidents. They drove one family who owned a business in Greenville out of town. And then they captured another Jewish man and cut off his earlocks, his hair, and shaved his beard. And, you know, they talked about how funny it was, how amused they were by the whole incident. But other than that, I found nothing else as far as anti-Semitism in those early years.
And see, the irony of all of this, Diane, is there were only a handful of persons of color in Greenville County. There weren't a whole lot to begin with. But that same group rode somebody out of town on a rail, which, of course, is a rather painful experience.
Right.
But let's move on from the early years into the 20th century, because this is when Jewish entrepreneurs, particularly in the mid-20th century, make a huge impact on the economy of upstate South Carolina.
That's right. And that's one of my main arguments in this book, is that Jewish manufacturers had a major impact on upstate South Carolina, and yet we seem to know nothing about it. The capital relocation that took place between the North and the South, administered more or less by these Jewish entrepreneurs, has never been recognized. And I found, you know, I did a lot of census analysis and city directory analysis and established at least 30 Jewish companies that were founded in the upstate, particularly after World War I and World War II. The earliest manufacturers were here in the World War I area, but there were only a few. And then after World War II, they really began to proliferate. Most of them were clothing manufacturers who migrated from the mid-Atlantic states, New York, Pennsylvania. They were often the sons of Jewish immigrants who worked in the needle trades in places like New York City. They learned the trade, but because many of them were educated, they moved into owning their own companies. So we have a proliferation of Jewish-owned garment industries in Spartanburg, Greenville, and smaller towns like Anderson, Easley, you know, some of the most innovative garment manufacturers are located in these towns and cities.
Diane, you were talking about a migration of these mostly young Jewish men into the South post, I guess, World War II, right? And these are the people who began to start these manufacturing entities in clothing, et cetera. Do we know what caused that migration? Was it simply a land of economic opportunity for them, or was there a lack of opportunity where they were coming from?
No, actually, there were a lot of advantages that South Carolina offered. One of the problems with the clothing manufacturers in the Northeast, particularly places like Lowell, Massachusetts, and, you know, the whole Northeast was filled with clothing manufacturing companies. They were experiencing labor problems. In the early 20th century, a lot of the companies went on strike for better wages, shorter working hours, and a lot of the Jewish manufacturers found South Carolina especially inviting for a myriad of reasons. Number one, I mean, there were the natural source resources, the waterways, which, of course, you need for manufacturing enterprises. But in addition to the resources, there was transportation, good transportation by the early 20th century, railroads, etc. But most of all, South Carolina was anti-unionism. South Carolina gains a reputation as being an anti-union state. And that sounded pretty good to a lot of manufacturers because they were suffering because of the demands being made by the unions. So you put all of those factors together, along with the fact that there was a large workforce and state incentives. South Carolina offered out-of-staters a lot of tax incentives, sometimes free land, and it made it very appealing for these people from the Northeast to come down to the to South Carolina.
Well, not only manufacturing, you've got some other interesting success stories like Henry Jacobs and One Price Clothing, which became a national chain.
Right. Henry Jacobs was actually not a migrant. He was born in Spartanburg. And he learned a lot about business and clothing from his stepfather, who owned a company in Spartanburg. He went to college in Massachusetts, met his future wife there, and then they moved back to Spartanburg so that he could join his stepfather's business. After years of working with his stepfather in a clothing company, he set out to start his own retail store, One Price Clothing, which was a huge success, not only in the South, but throughout, you know, multiple countries. And it really became a very, very successful company.
Well, we also have probably one of the better known success stories, of course, is Max Heller, who came to this country after World War II.
Yeah, you probably know a lot about the background, and I won't spend a lot of time on it, Walter. But Max met a young girl from Greenville at a dance hall in Vienna. He was born and raised in Vienna, Austria. This girl's name was Mary Mills, and they agreed to keep in touch with each other. Well, in the next couple of years, things got really rough in Vienna for Jews. This is the period when, you know, Hitler came into power. He marched into Austria, and Max Heller and his family are really in fear. They don't know what to do. Max told his family one night at a Seder dinner, "We need to get out of Vienna." But, you know, how do they do that? Well, Max decided to get in touch with Mary Mills in Greenville and asked her if there was any way she could help them. And Mary Mills agreed. And she went to Shepard Saltzman, who owned the Piedmont Shirt Company in Greenville and asked if there was anything he could do to help Max Heller and his family get out of Vienna. And of course, at that time, you needed a sponsor. You couldn't just leave the country and come to America. You had to have someone who would sponsor you, who would vouch for you, who would offer you a job and give that as a promise of your ability to make it in the United States. So Shepard Saltzman did that. He sponsored Max Heller and many members of the Heller family, promised them jobs so they could get to Greenville. And that's exactly how Max Heller got his start in the Piedmont Shirt Company, working with Shepard Saltzman for several years. And then after he learned the business and felt he had gone as far as he could with Shep, he decided to start his own company. And he did. He started a small company at first in Williamston. Then he came back to Greenville and started the Maxon Shirt Company.
And then, of course, he became a pillar of the Greenville community and mayor of the city.
Exactly. And I don't know if you want me to talk a little bit about him as a mayor. It's one of the best things that ever happened to Greenville.
Yeah. All right. I would love to if we had a time for a whole other show, but Diane Alford has given me the wind-up sign. So any last words you'd like to leave with our listeners today?
Thank you for having me on your program. And I really think it's important for the people of South Carolina to understand what an impact the Jews had on creating a viable, energetic economy throughout the state. We've known it for a long time about Charleston, and with my book, now we're learning it about the upstate.
Diane, it was a pleasure to have you on the Journal today to talk about your book, Peddlers, Merchants, and Manufacturers, How Jewish Entrepreneurs Built Economy and Community in Upcountry South Carolina. It is really quite a story and an interesting part of South Carolina history. I hope you enjoyed our conversation today. I know that I did. In Peddlers, Merchants, and Manufacturers, Diane Vecchio has given us a new perspective on Jewish history in South Carolina, one that looks outside of Charleston to explore the Jewish community's impact on life across the upcountry, which is vital to understanding the growth of today's Spartanburg-Greenville corridor.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. I'm Alfred Turner, and I produce the show, which is made possible by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina. The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio or its underwriters.
New episodes of Walter Edgar's Journal are published on the first and third Fridays of the month and are available at southcarolinapublicradio.org, on the SCETV app, as well as your favorite podcast provider. We'll talk again soon.